Welcome to Captivate the Room with your host, internationally known voice expert, Tracy Goodwin, an award-winning speaker who has taught hundreds around the globe to make a big impact with their voice. This podcast is for anyone who wants to step onto a bigger stage, make a bigger impact, and have a voice that makes people listen. Presentation matters, and the voice is the missing link. Join in and you'll see why.
Welcome, everybody. I'm so glad you're here with me. I can't even tell you how excited I am about my guest today. This is such a treat, and I'm so excited about this interview. Today with me, I've got Jean Maripodi, who's got some great letters behind her name, PhD, CPLP, and I'm going to ask her about those in a little bit. But she is a passionate educator, lifelong learner, with 15 plus years in corporate training, get this, in banking, retail, printing, nonprofits, and healthcare. This woman understands trends and needs in so many industries. Jean was trained, there's even more. She was trained as a teacher. She taught preschool, special and elementary education, and spent 5 years in higher education, where she led her e-learning team to win 3 national awards in 2014. And that's where I met Jean on the e-learning, in the e-learning world. And we're going to talk about that. She's wholeheartedly invested in literacy, volunteering her time in adult education, teaching English and reading to the lowest literacy learners. She just never stops. This woman is amazing. She's a CPLP, which is ATD's highest credential, and has a PhD in adult education, along with a master's degree in online instructional design. She's the chief learning architect at Apple Star Productions, designing, learning, and presenting workshops on instructional design, e-learning, and literacy. Jean, thank you so much for being here and welcome.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, you and I met when you were in the online world, correct? I was trying to think today how long we've known each other.
Golly, maybe it's been 5 years, 6 years. No, let me think about that. It may even be 7, because when I was at New England College of Business and I was doing instructional design, the first course I wrote was interpersonal communication. And when I was looking for resources, I stumbled on the videos that you had done as the Red Sweater Lady in iVillage. And they were just so exceptional, and students would love to talk about your videos in class because they'd learned so much and found them so practical. So I reached out to you and said, hey, what is this? And it was so much fun having you. Even by the discussion,
you know, I was trying to think about it today. I thought, when did I meet her? And I always equate things with what apartment I was living in. And I think I met Jean when I was living in that little apartment at 4T over in New York. And I remember the very day you reached out to me, I was so touched, and I had the opportunity of I did a lecture for the students, and it was so much fun. It was just such a treat to be with Jean, and I've observed some of her other online courses, and really an amazing, amazing instructor.
Thank you.
What did you find, and we're going to get into our topic in a minute, which is what I'm most excited about, because we both have a whole lot to say about it, but what did you find was the greatest communication challenge working on the college level?
Well, I was dealing with a unique college population. I was dealing with people that were working adults. Mm-hmm. The typical student at NECB was 35, married, and working full time. And for mm-hmm. them, it was getting the message that they thought they were sending across to the other side. They didn't realize how much extraneous stuff they had in there, and especially in this case, they never asked needed. They never needed. Here's what I need you to respond to the information.
I'm not getting any of it. Okay. I'm not getting any of that answer. It's completely going out. It's like I have you strong and then I lose you.
Let me see if I can do a hard wire. We got a new router.
Oh, okay.
And let's see if I plug the Ethernet in the back. Let's see if that helps.
Let's see. Yeah. All right. I'll just connect it directly to the internet.
So that it's not on Wi-Fi. Hola. Okay, let's see if we come back now. That.
Okay, so yeah, let's see if it'll work. I'll stop you if it doesn't work and we'll figure out what's going on. And the recording might end up being okay. But that first time you were a little glitchy. This time I was getting none of it.
Okay, I can switch headsets too if you want me to try that. But I'm guessing it's more likely the internet.
That's what Wi-Fi. I'm thinking too. Okay, so now, before we get into our big topic, which I know everybody's going to be the most excited about is when we get into the big topic, but I want you to talk to us a little bit about when you were teaching on the college level, because I taught on the college level, and you had a very unique experience, but I want you to talk to us about what you found to be the greatest communication challenge among your students.
Well, I was working with working adults. The students that attended New England College of Business tended to be 35, married, often owned their home. They were working and had gone back to school. All right.
Not getting any of it.
Let's try this headset.
It's funny, I was on one earlier and I had to take my headset out. I don't understand sometimes how the headset messes it up, but I guess it does.
Okay, how about this? And it's funny because I can hear you so clearly.
Yeah, it's weird.
But, okay, is that sound okay?
Yeah, and it comes in strong and then it would go completely away.
Okay, well, let's try that again.
Okay, so before we get into our big topic, which is what I'm most excited about, when you were teaching on the college level, did you find to be the greatest communication challenge for the students?
Well, one of the things at NECB that was unique is that NECB was made up of working professionals. The average student was 35, married, often with kids, and owning their own house. But one of the things that I saw very, very consistently was that the message they thought they were communicating often wasn't the message they intended to go out. In business writing in particular, they would write and send an email, but never ask anything, never indicate what they wanted the person to do. So they were dumping information at them, but they really didn't know what they were supposed to do with that information. Mm. So it was learning to anticipate what you were looking for from the other person.
I love that. I love that. And I just wonder if that's not a beautiful segue into what we're going to talk about tonight. I know that with most of my clients in voice work, as you guys know, I do teach presentation skills and public speaking and on-camera training, but my true specialty is voice. And one of the things I see with even my voice clients is the perception of what they're putting out is not what the audience is receiving.
That's right.
And it sounds like the exact same thing. Well, you know, you and I think we hit it off initially. One of the reasons we hit it off so well is because we are cut from the same cloth.
Mm-hmm.
We are cut from the same cloth of speakers of truth.
Oh, most definitely.
Speakers of truth.
Yeah. Not me.
Yeah. And I never was. And, you know, that was a problem for me. That was a problem for me. And, you know, I always in my early years took that as a negative. I was always told that was a negative. You know, I'm difficult. I'm hard-headed. I'm stubborn. And, you know, I think I was always this way. Do you feel like you were always a speaker of truth?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. The research literature is supporting that now. If you look at the work about positive deviants and you look at the work about rebels at work, they're people who come with ideas and they want to challenge the status quo because they see a better way, not because they're trying to be argumentative, not because they're trying to be negative, but because they see a problem and they see a problem that could be fixed and usually have an idea how to do that. And I'm sure that probably happened with you because you look at things in a different way.
Right, right. And I, you know, I've got that on my list to talk about. Jean wrote an incredible, incredible article, and I'm going to put it in the show notes. You have got to check this article. Jean, we're going to say this at the end of the show, but tell us what your website address is.
Sure. I'm at applestar.org, and my blog is linked right there along with most of the work that I do.
Well, this article, I'm actually going to pull from this article for this interview tonight because it was absolutely incredible. You know, Jean and I are the type that we always were the rebels, like you say, the deviants, if you will. And, you know, some people aren't. And what I'm wondering is, why do you think some people are so passionate about speaking their truth and other people don't speak their truth? Do you have any insight or thoughts on that?
Oh, clearly. A lot of it is fear. Mm-hmm. Fear in two ways. Fear that my idea isn't really a good idea and that it doesn't matter. And secondly, fear that the higher-ups will see you as being difficult or challenging. And then you have the difficult, and then you have the leadership who is often scared to death that, oh my God, somebody is seeing that the emperor really doesn't have any clothes on and is saying something. Just like the people in that story, the people all wanted to shush that child, but the child was speaking the truth. And mm-hmm. It wasn't until the emperor recognized the voice of the child that he realized, oh boy, I have been duped by these people who are sewing this clothes that doesn't exist. And so often that happens in corporations. And it's so fascinating. That story is very, very old. So it's been a problem that's gone on for a long time.
Well, and you personally just had an experience that just like what we're talking about. And if you don't mind, I want to read a couple of lines from this dialogue that you have in this blog post. It's just, I just sat here speechless before I could even read on. You said there's a major problem here and we need to fix it. You're cut off. Yes, we all know there's a problem. You need to stop harping on it. You say, but don't you see this is just like, and of course you bring up the emperor has new clothes. And the boss says, yes, it is. We all know that this is a problem. Nothing's going to change. No one's going to fix it. We need to stop talking about it. And of course you say, but we could, I don't care. We are not going to fix this. It's not our problem. Wow.
That's almost verbatim.
How in the world, you know, I sat there and just had this rush of thoughts. How can this be real? How can this happen? How can this be okay? Jean, how can this be okay? How can we continue to function in a broken system?
Well, it's not okay. It's absolutely not okay because if things are going to get better, they have to change. And mm-hmm. in many organizations, they're willing to settle for complacency and they're willing to deal with something that's okay. In this particular organization, I would say it appears that Rip Van Winkle is running your technology department and hasn't woken up yet. And that was a major issue that created big problems to try to get things done. And it required people to do lots of workarounds. And it was problematic and it was going to cost the company a lot of money to fix, but it was going to cost them more the longer they waited, unfortunately. And the management would say, oh, yes, challenge things. We need to make things better. But if you challenge them, you got in trouble. It was also a culture mm-hmm. of blame. And that's problematic. Mm-hmm. For a culture where if you want to encourage innovation, you have to allow for mistakes. You have to allow for people to try different things. And you have to allow for people to unravel the red tape that is often unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that links to fear as well? Or do you think that all links to money? Or both?
I think it may be both. I mean, they're afraid of what happens if we untangle this stuff. We clearly put this stuff in place for a reason, but oftentimes that reason has changed, and there's really no reason to have 17 layers of approval. Here's a great example. I wanted to do a book discussion with my team and was told, you can't buy those 12 books unless it gets executive approval at the C-level. And I thought, you have got to be kidding me. We're not talking about thousands of dollars. We're talking about 10 books or 12 books. And I'm guessing some division leader bought books for a whole big division and created a problem because they bought stuff people didn't use. And they were going to never let that happen again. And so they instituted a policy. There were policy after policy that were set in place that made no sense. I booked a room to stay at a conference and found a bed and breakfast that was $40 a night cheaper than the hotel. It was close enough for me to walk, so I wasn't going to need to rent a car. And there was a promotion on Black Friday that if you bought $350 in gift certificates, you got $100 free. So by the time we were done, I was probably saving the company close to $500 or $600. Mm-hmm. And when I put it in for approval, I was told, no, 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 we're not approving that because you didn't follow policy to book.
Oh my gosh.
And I challenged that and I said, what are you saying here? You mean I should spend $500 or $600 more to stay in compliance with your policy? And with a straight face, my boss said, uh-huh. And I thought, this is lunacy. Are you thinking about what you're saying? And here comes speaking the truth to say that makes no sense. Let's look at the bigger picture.
That's just mind-bending to me that they would waste money over a policy.
Oh, absolutely. Over and over again. I spent $1,500 on a software that allowed us to do project planning, but it was in the cloud. Oh, the evil cloud. And they wanted to ensure that we weren't going to have issues. And so in order to do the explorations that they wanted, we had to upgrade to the enterprise level, which cost $9,000. And I said, so we should spend $9,000 instead of $1,500, even though we really only need $1,500 worth of stuff. Yeah. Because after all, it's the cloud. Now, you know, Tracy, most of the enterprise work now goes through the cloud. It's not new technology, but it was fear. And that fear caused spending of lots and lots and lots of money unnecessarily.
And do you think that's coupled with control, or do you think that's just sheer fear?
I think it's a little of both. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little of both in certain managers, it's about control and making sure my people stay in line. And if they aren't in line, it reflects on me, which I honestly think reflects back to their childhood somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, there's stuff going on there that they have to keep things in control so that they look good and they want to please their superiors instead of looking at what are we doing for the company. But that's fear.
Right, right. Well, and that's a whole ineffective communication thing. You know, sell out this one to save this one because I've got to look good, you know, and I'm kind of easing my way into speaking your truth and getting land blasted for it. But I have one more question on this because I'm fascinated with this. I left the corporate world years ago, and my corporate world was university world. You know, I never really was in the corporate world like you are, but I was in the university world for many years. But will that ultimately be the demise?
Absolutely.
Or will it continue? You know, it can. I mean, how long can it continue to limp along, policy after red tape? You know, one's got to wonder, will the dominoes fall?
Well, you look at the new companies that are nimble and able to spin things on a dime. You look at the culture of Google and Pixar and cultures that are very creative, but also extraordinarily productive. They have things going on that allow for collaboration, that allow for new ideas, that allow for testing of the water. I don't know that we'll see a Google-esque culture in the financial industry or the insurance industries because they are so highly regulated, because people who work outside of the boundaries created problems. But there's also a lack of trust there. When you look at the work of Stephen Covey and the speed of trust, when you trust and empower employees, your company grows exponentially. It's because people are feeling like they have some control instead of being controlled like a minion.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that year I spent down in Austin, I was amazed, and I lived downtown, and I was amazed at all, you know, so many startups and so much in tech down there. And I had a friend in my building, and he worked for a glass company, and he said, you see that building over there? And I can't remember the name of the company. It was this their t-shirt slogan was Chive On. I mean, it's a big, big thing blowing up down there. He said, my company's building a glass beer slide for the office. And I said, what? You know, and UTEP was right across from us. And three nights a week, they were in there playing darts, and the people brought their dogs to work. And I mean, it was this culture like I didn't grow up with, you know, I grew up in that blue suited culture, but look at how people are flocking down there to work for those people. And those companies are thriving.
And they're willing to give long hours because they feel valued and they're vested in what the company is doing. It's not punch in at 9 and leave at 5.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, that culture speaks for itself. They are valued. We will spend money on our people, but I think you nailed it. And this is really the meat and potatoes of our talk today. They care what those people have to say. They care what those people think.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it makes me wonder, in cultures like that, is it as dangerous to speak your truth?
No. Right. No, I think that they have cultivated their leaders to be able to listen. Now, when you hear about Steve Jobs, you hear the good, the bad, the ugly about him. But yet he had to be doing some right things to allow people to innovate and move forward. And he had to have surrounded himself with people that could embrace that kind of thinking. I just read an article about CEOs and all the different ways they run meetings. And they're all so different, just like we are all very different. You know, one has one-on-one meetings with everybody. One has four-hour meetings. One sends a memo after everything. And they all have their different strategies that are effective. But I think they've learned to connect with people and respect people and recognize that they are capable if you allow them to be capable. And I've been a manager, and when you see a gap, you work with the gap, but you leverage the strengths of your people and you allow your people to interact with each other to create a sense of unity and collaboration and need. We need each other to be successful and to create a sense of safety so that it's okay. I have a great example of that on my team. One of my people made an offhanded joke when I got called for the grand jury. Now in Rhode Island, and maybe this happens in other states, when you get called for the federal grand jury, it's a 1-year commitment. And so every other Tuesday, I spend my whole day downtown listening to what feels like a mashup of Law and Order. And it changes at every commercial because they're doing different cases that are overlapping. And he said, well, if it was me, I would just say, string them all up. And he said that would get you out of jury duty. And one of my staff confronted him on that. And she said, do you realize how awful what you just said was? And I realized at that point, we had created a place where people could challenge each other when something they said was problematic. And that was allowing a safe place to do that. And he respected her for doing that. Now, his initial thought was, well, I was just joking. Everybody knows that. But her point was, what you said was politically incorrect, and you're advocating that we should be killing people the way we did in the 60s. Now, she's older than I am, and so she lived through the rights. Mm-hmm. And actually, I found out she had gone down to Selma to some of the marches. And so she was very vested in that. But she was able to recognize something that made him think twice. Mm-hmm. So it allowed for that growth for him and for her to be willing to take the risk to step out. And that was speaking her truth in a place where she took a risk. If you think about the work of Crucial Conversations, which is a work by the folks at Vital Smarts, they say that when companies and people are stuck, it's always because people aren't willing to have one or two crucial conversations. And they're not allowing for the truth to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. They talk about crucial conversations as conversations where there's some point of conflict and something's at risk. And there's a third value that I don't remember, whether it was power or something, but being willing to state that. And rebels like me are willing, because what the heck? What have I got to lose? Well, sometimes you do lose.
And I want to talk about this positive deviance in corporate rebels that you speak so beautifully about. And certainly it's in the article that you wrote that is so fantastic. And these are your rule breakers. I'm reading from the article here in front of me. The rule breakers, or at least the rule benders, who are always checking the edges and seeing the holes rather than the net. They're passionate about what they do, which supports them as they work against social convention. They look for what's going right. They look at resources they do have and figure out where to get more. They ask the right questions, flipping the usual ones on their heads. Why is in an example, and this is from a book that you can tell us all about this here in a minute. Why is the staff infection rate so low on Ward 4? And I think that's what people like you and I are, you know, positive deviants and corporate rebels. And so I want you to talk about that to us. But I also want you to talk about, is the risk worth it?
Okay. Well, the folks, the concept of positive deviance came out of the work from Save the Children. There were folks that were assigned to go and look at malnutrition and study malnutrition. And they were sent to a place that malnutrition was very high, let's say 75%. And instead of looking at what's causing the malnutrition, they said, well, why are 25% not malnourished? And they examined the outliers, and they examined the mothers who were feeding their children more often, who were finding ways to find food and not just settling because they knew that it was important. And they looked for ways to emulate and imitate that kind of thing on the outside. They talk throughout their book about medical cases where, you know, you look at the staff infections being so huge throughout an organization, but one ward is less. Why? What's going on that's different, that's obviously working? Now, when a positive deviant will come into a culture, they'll come in with a different perspective and they'll say, well, wait a minute, we don't have to do it this way. We don't have to do this and this and this and this and this. What if we did this, which would bring us to that? The process improvement people look at that and diagram that, but it's taking that big picture look that people will be just happy to sit and look at their tree and forget that there's a forest. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find when people are in crisis and they're a problem is they get so close to it, they go to bark view. Mm-hmm. And when you're in bark view, all you see is that little piece right in front of you, and you can see the ripples and the curls and the cracks and maybe the ant running around, but you don't see the tree, let alone the forest.
Yeah.
And you need that outside perspective of someone who says, wait a minute, let's look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's threatening. It's scary to say maybe we're not doing it the right way. I can't tell you how many times I heard, well, we don't do it that way.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe we don't.
Right. And that goes back to that fear and control and policy and regimen and nothing outside of the box. Nothing outside of the box.
But yet it's the outside of the box activity and thinking that often generates the innovation.
And do you think that that is why some of these industries that we see that are just taking off, because that's what they're doing?
Oh, sure. I think
they're embracing the positive deviant and the corporate rebel. That's what's running the show.
Oh, I think for a great extent, there's a lot that's happening in there. I think many of them are embracing design thinking and other methodologies that look at a bigger picture before they jump in with whatever solution is to whatever problem. They make sure to vet ideas and consider the user and consider the audience and examine maybe things systemically to see what happens. I have watched more than one change initiative that has dominoed because nobody thought about, well, if we fix this, what happens to that? Well, that's what you got to look at, and you have to think about that. You have to consider. You have to consider more than just the immediate in front of you sometimes.
Do you think that the, you know, and I don't like to blanket statement and put people in categories, but do you think the millennials, we're going to see a lot more of this with the millennials than maybe in our generation? Do you think they're driving this?
I think absolutely. Millennials are used to working on teams in schools. Mm. In schools, they were used to doing activities together. But think about it. Mommy schlepped you to the soccer team, and mommy schlepped you to the running race, and mommy took you to piano lessons, and mommy took you here, and mommy took you there. But it was often a team-based sport. And so from the time a little kid was six, they were playing Little League or kicking a soccer ball around. But those activities were in the constraint of a team where you had a coach helping them get better at what they were doing, and they could see those kind of progressions going. So they're used to that kind of model. They're also used to technology resources so that the way things are don't necessarily have to be, because there's, well, what about, let's look and see what else there is out there. It's not necessarily stable. I mean, all of us were like that in our 20s. Let's go back to the generation ahead of us even. And who were the people having the sit-ins and fussing about the race issues? It was the college students. It wasn't the business people. It was the college students. So that's not necessarily unique to millennials. That's something that is generational.
Yeah. Well, and with technology, it changes so fast that by the time, if you've got a policy that you've got to jump through 37 hoops, that whole technology is going to shift by the time you can get that approval.
Yes, it is.
So they had to, there has to be a different way when you're working in that industry, and that industry is so dominant.
Absolutely.
You know, everything. I mean, you're a social media person. You understand that stuff and how fast it moves and how it is everything.
Absolutely. And we have to recognize that today's technology may be tomorrow's history. I was in a meeting today and they were talking about Second Life. And he talked about it as old technology. Second Life was really cutting edge when it came out. And I went in and I poked around and I thought, this is not going to do anything. But because it was more complicated than it needed to be, that was one reason. And it required too much of the user. So it didn't have a great adoption rate beyond the social media lovers who loved coming in and experimenting and the people who did some development in it. But it didn't stay. And so if you invest your world in something like that, well, it may be gone tomorrow. There's new stuff that's coming out there, and we need to be aware of that. I mean, even Blab. Blab is relatively new technology. We've had Skype that we could do this kind of thing, Google Hangouts, but Blab makes it easy. And Blab is gaining adoption tremendously, tremendously. You see Blab requests all over the place.
Yeah, I would say a third of my business now is people coming to me because they're uncomfortable on camera. Well, I've been on camera since the time I was 22, making my living doing television commercials.
Yeah, sure.
I never thought I would see this day. you know, where there's so much visibility. And if you're not visible, you're going to get left behind.
Oh, definitely. And you need to be able to present yourself well, even at the starting gate at an interview. You have to learn to do that. And your forte is communication. And the gap that I saw with my students is the gap that exists in all of us. Am I really who I say I am? And how do I present myself? And you don't want to present yourself as this phony mask kind of wearing person. You need to be authentic. And you want your best self to come forward wherever you are.
Well, and I don't know if you've noticed this, I bet you have, but I feel like the pendulum has really swung back. I feel like for years, we were very much behind the screen, very much the employers were hiring based on IQ and degree, and soft skills were important, but they weren't the priority. And I just keep reading article after article after article. We've hired all of these people, but yet can they have a conversation? And people are, you know, and employers and universities alike are realizing, wait a minute, we've got to teach these people how to speak and present. And I think it's because the stakes are so high. You know, when I was growing up, you could quit a job today and have three more lined up tomorrow if you wanted it.
That's right.
Well, today, if you can get an interview, you're lucky.
Because there's so much competition for the position. But yet, the unemployment, not the unemployment statistics, but the unfilled positions remain in many companies because people don't have the skill set to fill them. And college students today, are college freshmen today are preparing for jobs that don't exist yet because our world has changed so much and our world continues to change. So it's learning to learn, learning to be nimble, learning to adapt are critical skills. I have a friend who was doing interviewing to find a new manager for an operations position, and she interviewed several MBAs and would throw scenarios at them that they couldn't deal with. Now, it was simple problem solving. It wasn't a super complex problem. If you graduate with the letters behind your name, we assume you know something. But a lot of times it's you knew how to take a test, or you knew how to write a paper. You know, if we are teaching, I'm an instructional designer, and I harp all the time at the end, what should they know and do? And that was a paradigm shift I brought to the college. If a student is taking accounting 101, it's not so he can complete the problem set. It's designed so that he can go forward and he can do accounting in a setting. That's what we want them to have. We want to have some skills here.
So it's interesting when you were talking earlier about the fear in, you know, with people and anything out of the norm and any of the challenges. And it made me think of several things. And I wondered, you know, when we were talking about people being afraid to speak their truth, and in the corporate world, it made me, I just got to thinking about, I wonder if some of that fear is driven by all the downsizing. You know, you were talking about fear of the boss and fear of the this, and you rattled off several fears for us, but it almost feels to me like selling your soul. You know, I've got to hold on to this job so badly that I cannot even say what I need to say.
Sure. Well, Bill Jensen, in his book, in his report on the future of work and his book, Future Strong, talks about how you have to be your own advocate. You know, you are the one who's got the career that you're working forward on, and you bring this to the company. And he also talks about the model of a lot of contract employees coming in for a project, and you go in, you do the project, and then you move on to the next thing as the wave of the future. That lets you do what you do best without having to deal with a lot of the politics. But you talked about selling your soul. Yeah, I think a lot of people do that. And I think we lose out on a lot of ideas because of that. One of the trends that I've seen about mentorship is not only finding a person older, more senior, whatever, to mentor you, but to look for a 20-something to be involved with so that you can learn from their perspective. My niece, Sarah, she's 27. She moved in with us, and it's been really an eye-opening experience for us because she's talking about music and she's talking about movies and TV shows that not only have we not seen, but we haven't heard of. And she'll talk about, you know, old people like Madonna and like, wow.
Oh, brother. Okay, yeah. Oh, brother.
But that's the perspective. I read an article today about the Windows Start Menu, which celebrates its 20th birthday this year because it came out with Windows 95. And 20 years ago, the high school student who's graduating 2 years ago, who's now a sophomore in college, never knew life without a start menu. That's their paradigm.
Wow, yeah.
That's something to be aware of and for sure for us to consider the broader picture than just our nice little box.
And, you know, it's just so true. And I rejected that vehemently for some time. You know, years ago, I was way too bogged down in, you don't have the experience. You don't have you don't have the credibility. You haven't done what I've done, you know, and that was very short lived because, especially with technology, because I can't function without those people now.
Yeah.
You know, I got my first cell phone was the size of my handbag in 1987, you know, and now they run multi-million dollar businesses from their iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it enables that kind of thing. But then you look at the flip side of cultures, the Asian cultures, where the wisdom of age is valued and revered. You know, in American culture, not so much. Not so much. We have to look for balance and recognize that the young and the old both bring value and allow both of them to speak their truth and be willing to listen to it.
Well, and that sounds like the whole core of the problem of what we started with, the lacking the balance. You know, well, we've done it this way forever. Well, we got to check the policy. Well, you're a problem because you're challenging that because you've got an idea, you know, you've got a creative idea that could create a solution, but we don't have a policy on that. So we've got to let you go. kind of set up.
And you look at it and you think, what? Wait. But it's scary. It's frightening. I mean, I have said to more than one person that I was courted to come to this company to make change, which was fine as long as they didn't have to change anything.
Yeah.
And that's just so ironic. But I don't think they've seen that yet. I suspect there'll be some 2020 hindsight as themes rise up again and again, and they'll say, oh yeah, she was saying that. And I don't consider myself a futurist. I mean, I try to be on the cutting edge. I try to stay current with technology, and I try to stay current with what's going on in my industry because that's really important. And I don't consider myself way out there, but when I'm with certain groups, I think you guys are 10 years behind the curve here. Where have you been? They don't stay on top of things.
Well, you know what I think about you, Jean, and this is where I see the difference between people. And this is what I love about you the most, what I've always loved about you the most, because I'm the same way. And that is the ability to say, this doesn't work. This does work versus, okay, all right. And let it all stay in. This is what I see people. This is one of the reasons I think people think they can't communicate because they never say, they hold it in. And then one day they explode and vomit this venom. And then the first thing they say to themselves is, well, I'm a terrible communicator. I'll just not say anything. And then the whole thing repeats itself. So it's, you know, what a trade, you know, the risk. And so I go back to that question, is the risk worth it? You know, is the risk worth it to lose that job, to to get reprimanded, to get written up, to be the one in the office that nobody likes. You know, all those scenarios that I think play in people's head to make him upset, to make her upset, to set him off, you know, so just don't say anything.
But that comes out of the model of punishment. That comes out of the model of when I do something wrong, I'm going to get scolded and put in the corner, or I'm going to get sent to the principal's office. Now, my husband was the headmaster of a school, several different schools. He had this mean face. He would work on cultivating it. And he said it was really hard sometimes to put on his mean face for this six-year-old who got in a fight over something dumb. And the kid is crying. And, you know, they came to their senses in doing that. But it was the model of authority that was in there. And the flip side of that comes out of the people who are looking at innovation and looking at a failure as an opportunity to learn and say, wow, well, what can we learn from that? And how can we fix it? And what will we do differently next time? That's a whole different perspective. So learning to model that as a leader is really, really important. And sometimes it's learning to gulp and say, ouch, that stung. But let's talk about it, you know, being willing to listen first.
Well, this was just great. I just want to say such a special thank you to Jean for taking the time to be here with us today to talk about taking the risk and speaking your truth and the value of communication and leadership. I encourage everyone to follow Jean. She is an incredible writer and such an intelligent woman. She writes some amazing pieces, and you can find her at applestar.org, and that's where her blog is. And she also tweets some fantastic stuff at J Maripodi on Twitter. Jean's also a learning junkie, as she calls it, and you can find her speaking at a number of instructional design conferences around the country. So thank you for being here, Jean. Thank you all so much, listeners. Thank you for your shares and downloads. And I look forward to seeing you next time. In the meantime, get out there and speak your truth. Just do it beautifully.